who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 2nd, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: Gunver said founder Torbjørn Tornquist would leave the commodities trading company and sell his stake to employees. After the Trump administration pilloried the firm over its alleged ties to Moscow, Bitcoin declined more than 6% in its biggest one-day drop since March, trading at $85,468 as of 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday, and down more than 30% from a peak above $126,000 in early October. Shares of Strategy decreased 3.25%, contributing to a slide that has erased nearly half the Bitcoin buying company's market capitalization this year. Yields on government debt climbed around the world after the Bank of Japan governor surprised investors by hinting at a potential interest rate increase later this month. Silver prices climbed to records as expectations that the Fed will cut interest rates further this month and concerns over global supply tightness sparked a fresh rally. Netflix has sweetened its offer for Warner Brothers Discovery as it tries to outdo rival Paramount. Barrick Mining is considering spinning off its North American gold assets into a listed business. Airbus identified a quality issue with metal panels used to build its A320 family of aircraft days after the company warned that thousands of the jets required a software fix. Spotify experienced an outage on Cyber Monday that interrupted transactions for some merchants on its e-commerce platform. Switzerland's Attorney General filed criminal charges against UBS and a former Credit Suisse compliance officer in connection with a bond scandal that spanned continents. Apple is shaking up its AI ranks, poaching a Microsoft executive, and reorganizing after announcing the retirement of its top AI leader. Costco sued the Trump administration over tariffs in an effort to secure a full refund should the Supreme Court rule the duties illegal. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. The White House acknowledged that the U.S. military conducted a second strike on an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean in September, deepening questions about Hegseth's role in an operation that led to the killing of two survivors. An appeals court ruled that Alina Haba can't serve as the acting U.S. attorney in New Jersey, saying that the government maneuver that put her there was inadmissible. Air travelers without a real ID compliant form of identification will be required to pay a $45 fee to pass through airport security starting on February 1st. Sudan's military government offered Russia what would be its first naval base in Africa and an unprecedented perch overlooking critical Red Sea trade routes. Britain will spend more on new medicines in exchange for avoiding tariffs on UK pharmaceutical exports to the US. Trump urged voters to cast a ballot for the Republican House candidate in a Tennessee special election that has become a tight race. More than 800 people remained missing after floods killed more than 1,000 people last week in Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and Thailand. New York City will get three big casinos after a state commission awarded licenses to Mets owner Steve Cohen and two other operators. A son of notorious Mexican drug pin El Chapo pleaded guilty to U.S. drug trafficking charges. The picture on today's front page shows Pope Leo greeting a group of nuns. And that caption reads, "Praying Hands." A group of nuns gleefully welcomed the pontiff, who is visiting the Middle East on a mission to rally the region's dwindling religious community he leads, as he arrived at the Catholic Basilica of Harisha, Lebanon, on Monday. And that headline, Pope Leo rallies flock in cradle of Christianity. The article, Pope visits a dwindling Mideast flock. Christians in Turkey and Lebanon have a rich heritage, but fear uncertainty. By Margarita Stancati and Omar Abdel Bakwi. Istanbul. Pope Leo XIV's trip to the Middle East is taking him to places where early Christianity flourished, but where that community is struggling. In Turkey, the number of Christians has declined to a historic low, while in Lebanon, where the Pope arrived Sunday for a three-day trip, emigration is reducing a larger population. Leo is seeking to make these communities feel less isolated and to encourage them to remain in their ancestral lands. There are times when it is easier to flee, Leo told Lebanese officials and diplomats Sunday in Beirut. However, we must not forget that remaining in our homeland and working day by day to develop a civilization of love and peace remains something very valuable. On a recent Sunday, priests, candle bearers, and a bishop sang a hymn in classical Armenian as they filed into the Holy Mother of God Patriarchal Church, the main place of worship of Turkey's Armenian Apostolic Church. We're worried that the community is getting smaller, but we're also worried that one day we will regret not leaving, said Tamar Gezer, a local worshiper. Many Christian families she knew as a child have left the country. Her 21-year-old daughter wants to move to France. Histo Paskalidis, a retired bazaar worker from Istanbul, said he would like more representation for Greek Orthodox Christians in government jobs. We would like to be civil servants, soldiers, prosecutors, just like we were in Ottoman times. Turkish authorities deny there is discrimination against Christians. Second strike on boat draws deeper scrutiny of Hegseth. Pentagon chief authorized attack that killed survivors. He cites Admiral's role. By Michael R. Gordon, Lindsay Wise, and Shelby Holliday. Washington. The White House said Monday that the U.S. military conducted two strikes on a boat in the Caribbean in September, deepening questions about Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's role in an operation that led to the killing of two survivors, Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley, the head of Special Operations Command, was acting legally under authority to use lethal force granted by Hegseth in conducting multiple attacks on the boat, White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt said. The White House defense of Hegseth came in response to a report in the Washington Post on Friday that he gave a spoken order to kill them all aboard the vessel. The first strike killed all but two of the 11 occupants before Bradley ordered a second missile strike, which killed the men, according to the Post. A Defense Department official on Monday provided a similar account to the Wall Street Journal and said Hegseth was the target engagement authority, the key figure who authorized the strike. President Trump said Sunday that Hegseth told him that he didn't issue an order to kill all the people on board. Pete said he did not order the death of those two men, Trump told reporters during a flight to Washington from Florida. And I believe him. But Trump later added, I wouldn't have wanted that, in response to questions about whether he favored targeting survivors. On Monday evening, Hegseth wrote in a social media post that the September 2nd attacks were Bradley's decision. Let's make one thing crystal clear. Admiral Mitch Bradley is an American hero, a true professional, and has my 100% support, Hegseth wrote. I stand by him and the combat decisions he has made on the September 2nd mission and all others since. Levitt said in a statement read to reporters at the White House that Bradley had directed the attacks. On September 2nd, Secretary Hegseth authorized Admiral Bradley to conduct these kinetic strikes, she said. Admiral Bradley worked well within his authority and the law, directing the engagement to ensure the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated. Bradley didn't respond to a request for comment. Crypto sell-off worsens in retreat from risk. Bitcoin dropped 6% as investors, feeling economic unease, unwind exposure. By Vicky G. Wang. The rout in cryptocurrency is intensifying. Bitcoin tumbled more than 6% on Monday, its biggest one-day drop since March. The world's largest digital currency traded at $85,468 as of 4 p.m. Eastern Time and is down more than 30% from a peak above $126,000 set in early October. The sell-off has spilled into other digital coins, including Ether and Solana, and pulled down stocks tied to the crypto market, such as exchange operator Coinbase Global and Strategy. Michael Saylor's Bitcoin Accumulation Company. Bitcoin and other digital tokens have been caught up in a broader decline, afflicting riskier trades across all markets. Unprofitable technology businesses, speculative shell companies, and meme stocks have all fallen out of favor in recent months. Investors are dialing down their risk exposure as they turn more pessimistic about the market and the economy, said Patrick Horsman, Chief Investment Officer at crypto treasury firm BNB Plus. I think we could see Bitcoin get all the way back to $60,000, Horsman said of Bitcoin. We don't think the pain is over. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Questions about NATO's future, Royal Europe, by Bertrand Benoit and David Ludnow, Berlin. This week will bring a split screen that will reinforce growing doubts in Europe about the U.S. commitment to the alliance that has served as the bedrock of Western unity since the end of World War II. On one side, White House Special Envoy Steve Witkoff will be in Moscow for the latest round of peace talks with the Kremlin over the Ukraine war. Witkoff, who has yet to visit Ukraine, is making his sixth trip to Moscow this year. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Marco Rubio will be skipping a biannual gathering of NATO foreign ministers and sending a deputy in his place. The last time the U.S.'s top diplomat didn't show up at the event was 1999, when Washington's focus was on Middle East peace, said a former NATO spokeswoman. His absence will be felt acutely, coming as it does in the middle of talks over ending the Ukraine war that have prompted many European leaders to question whether Washington's priorities are still aligned with those of Europe. A leaked plan and transcripts of a call between Witkoff and a top Kremlin foreign policy aide have left many with the impression that the Trump administration is more interested in improving ties and economic cooperation with Russia than defending the transatlantic alliance. Two aspects of the 28-point peace plan in particular landed like bombshells in Europe's defense and foreign policy establishment. First, the plan treated Russia as a clear winner and Ukraine as the loser, forcing Kyiv to give up strategic land it hasn't lost, shrink its military, and leave it without a guarantee of protection from either the U.S. or European allies should Russia rearm and come back for more. Second, it described the U.S. as a mediator between Russia and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, suggesting the U.S. no longer saw itself as a member of the alliance it has long dominated. It is a Versailles Treaty, except one that punishes the victim and rewards the aggressor, said Carlo Massala, professor of international politics at the Bundeswehr University, Munich, referring to the treaty that ended World War I. And I think it reflects the position of a certain faction in the U.S. government. The U.S.'s latest peace plan would go a long way toward dividing NATO by proposing what would amount to an amnesty for Russia for the invasion, allowing it to re-enter the G8 club of rich countries and pursue joint economic development plans with the U.S. in areas like the Arctic. That would create huge divisions within the transatlantic partnership. Politically, Russia is on the cusp of winning, said Ed Arnold, a former British Army infantry officer who specializes in European security analysis for the RUSI think tank. Car buyers balk at years of prices going up, by Sharon Turlip. For years, it has seemed no sticker price was too high for American car buyers. Even as an average new car prices approached $50,000 this year, dealers fretted more over depleted inventories than losing customers to sticker shock. Those days are coming to an end. Increasingly, stretched consumers are starting to draw the line on what they will pay for a new car, according to dealers, analysts, and industry data. Car buyers are downsizing, buying used vehicles, taking on longer car loans, and holding out for deals. People are asking, "How can I afford this?" said Robert Peltier, who owns dealerships in East Texas. He said traffic, while still solid, has slowed at his dealerships, and more customers are gravitating toward less costly cars, such as the pint-size Chevrolet Trax. There are people who are in debt and living paycheck to paycheck, he said. For the U.S. auto industry, 2025 was supposed to be a banner year fueled by tax cuts and a deregulatory wave. Some analysts predicted a third straight annual sales increase as automakers, which had been hit hard by coronavirus pandemic and semiconductor shortages, finally got their factories running full stream. Now, forecasts predict muted or no growth for the year, and more of the same in 2026. Factory output slows. U.S. manufacturing activity contracted for the ninth consecutive month in November, a development that manufacturers attribute largely to President Trump's tariffs. The PMI for manufacturing was below the 50 score that divides contraction from expansion. Fee of $45 for flyers lacking real ID, by Michelle Hackman and Allison Pohl. Air travelers without a real ID compliant form of identification will be required to pay a $45 fee to pass through airport security starting on February 1st. Under the new policy, travelers who hold an older form of ID will be required to pay the fee on pay.gov and show a receipt at an initial Transportation Security Administration checkpoint, the agency said Monday. They will then need to confirm their identity through a TSA system known as TSA Confirm ID, which can check a person's identity against passport data and other personally identifying information. The TSA began requiring a real ID upgrade, driver's license or identification card, or another compliant ID such as a passport on May 7th. Since then, the TSA said compliance has been high. Roughly 94% of flyers have presented an acceptable form of ID since the requirement went into effect. The fee will cover a 10-day period sufficient for most round-trip flights and must be paid before the traveler arrives at the airport. Travelers who don't have a compliant ID have been subject to additional screening measures and can be denied access to their flights if their identities can't be confirmed. Sudan offers Russia its first naval base in Africa, by Benoit Falcon and Nicholas Barrio. Sudan's military government has offered Russia what would be its first naval base in Africa, and an unprecedented perch overlooking critical Red Sea trade routes, according to Sudanese officials. The deal, if it happens, would be a strategic advantage for Moscow, which has struggled to deepen its foothold on the continent. It would be a troubling development for the U.S., which has sought to keep Russia and China from controlling African ports, where they could rearm and refit warships and potentially choke off vital sea lanes. Under a 25-year plan Sudan's military government presented to Russian officials in October, Moscow would have the right to station up to 300 troops and dock as many as 4 warships, including nuclear-powered ones, at Port Sudan or another yet-to-be-named Red Sea facility, the official said. The Kremlin also would get the inside track on lucrative mining concessions in Sudan, the third largest gold producer in Africa. From Port Sudan, Moscow would be well placed to monitor maritime traffic to and from the Suez Canal, the shortcut between Europe and Asia that carries about 12% of global trade. In exchange for allowing Russian forces the long-term use of its territory, the Sudanese officials said the country's beleaguered military regime would get advanced Russian anti-aircraft systems and other weaponry at preferential prices as it pursues the civil war with the rebel Rapid Support Forces. A senior U.S. official said a Russian base in Libya or at Port Sudan could expand its ability to project power and allow it to operate with impunity. An Airbus fuselage issue affects hundreds of jets, by Benjamin Katz and Andrew Tangel. Airbus has identified a quality issue with metal panels on hundreds of its best-selling A320 family of aircraft, a fresh setback days after the company warned that thousands of the jets required an urgent software fix. The European plane maker said on Monday that it was inspecting jets that may be affected by what it described as a supplier quality issue, a discovery that threatens to upend an already high-pressure scramble to meet full-year delivery targets. Airbus hasn't publicly disclosed the number of planes that may be affected, but told customers late last week as many as 628 jets could have defective panels installed, according to a confidential presentation reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. Of those planes, 168 are in service, while 245 others are in final assembly and being readied for delivery, Airbus engineers noted in the presentation. A further 215 are moving through earlier stages of production. The issue at hand is the thickness of 5 specific panels that sit on top of the cockpit on either side of the jet's right and left front doors. The defects were introduced during the stretching and milling process used to manufacture the panels, leaving some with patches that either exceed or fall short of thickness requirements, according to the presentation. The manufacturing fault has now been rectified, and all newly produced panels conform to requirements, an Airbus spokesman said on Monday. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Switzerland charges UBS and Credit Suisse tuna bonds flap. Developments are the latest in saga that began more than a decade ago. By Margot Patrick. Switzerland's Attorney General filed criminal charges against UBS and a former Credit Suisse compliance officer, saying they failed to take steps to prevent money laundering in what later became known as the Mozambique tuna bonds scandal. The charges are the latest in a saga that started around 2013 when Credit Suisse arranged $2 billion in debt deals for state-owned companies in Mozambique to buy tuna fishing vessels and other equipment. When the debt couldn't be repaid on time, it emerged that the money from the bonds was part of an epic fraud centered on cash bribes and secret fees. UBS, which took over Credit Suisse in a state-engineered rescue in 2023, said, "We firmly reject the Office of the Attorney General's conclusions and will vigorously defend our position." UBS was charged as criminally liable for the alleged money laundering as Credit Suisse's successor, though the alleged conduct took place in 2016. Prosecutors and regulators in the U.S., U.K., Mozambique, and Switzerland brought criminal and civil proceedings, and in 2021, Credit Suisse paid $475 million to settle charges that it defrauded some investors in the debt deals. It pleaded guilty to wire fraud conspiracy charges in the U.S., and Switzerland's financial regulator put curbs on it making new loans in corruption-prone countries. In this round, it isn't Credit Suisse's lending in question, but how it handled payments coming into a Credit Suisse client account from Mozambique's Finance Ministry. The Swiss Attorney General's office said it charged an unnamed female compliance officer in relation to $7.9 million in payments that she allowed to enter the bank. Shortly after the money came in, $7 million was sent to bank accounts in the United Arab Emirates, sparking questions within Credit Suisse. The compliance officer had numerous indications that the funds were suspicious, but her recommendation to a Credit Suisse management board was to sever the client relationship and not to report the payments to Swiss authorities as required, the Attorney General's office said. The bank's systems for risk management, compliance, and internal directives had considerable defects at the time, the office said. The suspected money laundering was only reported by Credit Suisse in 2019, according to the Attorney General, when Credit Suisse knew it was under criminal proceedings in the U.S. Later that year, after being arrested in London, three former Credit Suisse bankers pleaded guilty to charges in Brooklyn Federal Court. From the editorial page, the lesson of China's Japan bullying. The Chinese Communist Party is putting the squeeze on Japan to punish its new prime minister for telling the truth. Asked in Parliament on November 7th, Prime Minister Sanae Takaichi explained that an attack by Beijing on Taiwan would be survival threatening for Japan, potentially triggering a military response. Cue the weeks-long campaign of outrage and coercion as if it were Miss Taikachi rather than China's Xi Jinping, who is threatening to blow up the status quo. Beijing began its reply by firing up tensions around disputed and even undisputed islands, dispatching ships and drones. Chinese diplomats assailed Japan with one threatening, "We have no choice but cut off that dirty neck that has been lunged at us." From so-called wolf warrior diplomacy, Beijing escalated to economic sanctions. These have been kept informal, but that's no consolation to the affected Japanese industries. China told its citizens to avoid all travel to Japan, triggering a sharp and costly decline in tourism. By one estimate, 500,000 airline tickets from China to Japan were canceled in a few days. A ban on Japanese seafood imports also was suddenly reinstated, again on bogus concerns regarding nuclear contamination. The journal reports that China's President Xi spent half of his hour-long phone call with President Trump last week reciting his grievances regarding Japan and Taiwan. More worrying, Mr. Trump reportedly responded by promptly calling Japan's Miss Taikachi and telling her not to provoke Beijing over Taiwan. Nobody wants to provoke a confrontation over Taiwan. But who's issuing the provocations? The leader explaining how she might respond to an invasion, or the one planning, building toward, and threatening that invasion? The Japanese have no interest in a military clash with China, a nuclear-armed superpower. Tokyo might be pushed to that point only if Beijing's aggression gives it no other choice. Miss Taikachi is right that an invasion of Taiwan by Beijing would seriously endanger Japan. The fall of Taiwan would break the first island chain that gives Japan its defensive depth. Should that bulwark become a Chinese bridgehead, critical Japanese shipping lanes would be vulnerable to disruption or blockade. Japan relies on those shipping lanes to import much of its food and energy. The U.S. strategy of open sea lanes and a network of alliances in the Pacific would fall apart. China's economic coercion today is an omen of what's to come should it gain naval control of the region. As has been amply demonstrated against Japan and Australia before it, the Chinese won't hesitate to use their economic power to intimidate neighbors and even nations farther afield. Lithuania learned that the hard way when Beijing effectively embargoed all goods to and from the country earlier this decade. A diplomatic touch has always been necessary to avoid conflict over Taiwan. But the real danger here isn't a Japanese statement of reality. It's Beijing's growing use of military and economic power to threaten Taiwanese democracy. Mr. Trump will need Japan's help to ward off the worst of China's ambitions. From the opinion pages, a house cliffhanger in Nashville. Afton Ben, the AOC of Tennessee, could get elected in the city she has said she hates, by William McGurn. Afton Benn is the ideal Democratic candidate for Republicans in a red state to face. At least that used to be the thinking. Ms. Benn is a 36-year-old former community activist and healthcare organizer now serving in the Tennessee House. She has been dubbed the AOC of Tennessee for her left-wing views and antics. She is now vying with Republican Matt Van Epps in Tuesday's special election for Tennessee's 7th Congressional District. Mr. Van Epps is a Trump Republican in arguably the best state to be. He graduated from West Point, flew helicopters for the Army, and serves in the Tennessee Army National Guard. In Tennessee, he's a typical Republican. He calls himself an America First conservative, and his bio says he is guided by the principles of less regulation and more freedom. In a district that has been red since the Reagan administration, this race would normally be a cakewalk for the Republican. Although Mr. Van Epps is ahead, his lead is slim, 48% to 46%, according to Emerson. Only a year ago, Donald Trump carried the district by 22 points and Tennessee by 30. Most of the time, a Democrat wouldn't have a prayer in such circumstances, especially a Democrat who has made as many wacky statements as Ms. Benn. She is still having trouble giving a clear answer to a simple question. Does she stand by her past public statements? Here's a sampler. On the city she seeks to represent, Grits Podcast, February 2020. I hate the city. I hate the bachelorettes. I hate the pedal taverns. I hate country music. I hate all of the things that make Nashville barely an it city to the rest of the country. But I hate it. On the bigotry of her state. The Tennessean newspaper, March 27, 2019. Let me be clear. Tennessee is a racist state. Racism is in the air we breathe, permeating the state capitol, codified in the legislation being passed at the detriment of women, communities of color, and the working poor. Our problem with racism in this state is wild and untamed. On burning down police stations, Twitter, June 3rd, 2020. Good morning, especially to the 54% of Americans that believe burning down a police station is justified. On defunding the police, Twitter, June 8th, 2020. What's the proposal that dissolves a MNPD Nashville? On CNN's Inside Politics Sunday, host Manu Raju asked Ms. Benn if she regretted making these remarks. Instead of disavowing them, she answered that she wouldn't post such remarks today because she has matured. She added that those remarks were made when she was a private citizen and not an elected lawmaker. Her explanation doesn't satisfy because it suggests she still believes what she said, but doesn't want to alienate Tennessee voters by fessing up. The difference between now and when she made the remarks is that she's since learned how to hide better what she really believes, so she can't be called to account for it. Still, Republicans are pinning her to her past weirdness. get out and vote for Matt Van Epps, who has my complete and total endorsement, President Trump declared on Truth Social on Sunday. The radical left Democrats are spending a fortune to be one of the best candidates we've ever had, Mr. Trump wrote. He went on to list Ms. Benz's failings, a woman who hates Christianity and will take away your guns, is for men in women's sports, and openly disdains country music. Julian Epstein, a Democrat who formerly served as chief counsel for the House Judiciary Committee, on Sunday told Fox News that Ms. Benz was not a very serious candidate. All true enough. But why then is the race so close? For two reasons. First, taking a page from Governor-elect Mikey Sherrill, Ms. Benz is making her campaign all about affordability. Never mind that most of the policies she favors would make life less affordable. The same Emerson poll that showed Ms. Benz within 2 points of Mr. Van Epps shows that the top two issues in Tennessee's 7th District are bread-and-butter ones, the economy, 38%, and housing affordability, 15%. Second, Ms. Benz's affordability message seems to be trumping the effect of her kookier statements because she is filling a vacuum left by the White House, which remains quiet on an agenda to lower cost. Take health care. Republicans still don't have a coherent plan to fix Obamacare and use markets to give people more say over their health decisions. Until the GOP rolls out some actual ideas, it will be vulnerable to the affordability message. Mr. Van Epps is still likely to win Tuesday. But if Ms. Benz manages to make it a tight race in so red a district, what does that say for Republicans' prospects of keeping their majority in next year's midterm elections? You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Putin's choice, Peter the Great or Steve Witkoff. Russia and the U.S. talk of peace through profit, but Ukraine is in a fight for its very survival. By Gerard Baker. An old Kremlin joke about Vladimir Putin is that the Russian president has only three trusted advisors: Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, and Catherine the Great. I was reminded of the modern Tsar's historically animated ambitions by a report in the news pages of the Journal last week. U.S. and Russian negotiators are making diplomatic efforts to end the Ukraine war by establishing the basis for a lasting and mutually beneficial economic relationship between the former Cold War rivals. Make money, not war, was the gist of the offer the Russian government apparently pitched to President Trump. We can hazard a well-informed guess how our president responded to that proposition. But there's a problem. It is not only that we Americans should all feel revulsion at the idea that some free nation's sovereignty can be violently extinguished as long as we receive a cut of the action. It is that for Ukraine, Europe, the U.S., and the Russian leader too, making money and making war aren't and never have been mutually exclusive activities. The journal story documents how Kirill Dmitriev, head of Russia's sovereign wealth fund and a close Putin aide, and Steven Witkoff, the president's ambassador, plenipotentiary to everything, have drawn up a list of commercial opportunities for the U.S. and Russia, if only Washington would sign off on Mr. Putin's unlawful occupation of a neighboring country. The prospects on offer seem enticing. Rare earth mining and energy projects for U.S. investors in Russia's Arctic. Joint missions to Mars between Elon Musk's SpaceX and the Russian space industry. Appropriation of the $300 billion in Russian assets frozen by European central banks after the 2022 invasion to be used for collaborative investment in Russia and Ukraine. The picture Mr. Dmitriev painted for Mr. Witkoff was of Russia as a land of opportunity. The offer is so appealing, you wonder whether the American envoy and his colleagues were given the same sort of Potemkin village spectacle to which Tucker Carlson was treated on his visit to Moscow last year, the one where he expressed wonderment, for example, at the coin deposit and return system in Russian supermarket carts, technology that has been in almost every European store I have been in since 1990. That's not all. Mr. Witkoff seems to believe that the peace dividend on offer can benefit Ukraine too. In a very modern invocation of the swords to plowshares principle, he has evidently told Ukrainian officials that its demobbed soldiers could soon be earning Silicon Valley-level salaries, operating American data centers in the country. It's unclear whether Russia has been offered any investment opportunities in the U.S. as part of the deal. But we can at least hope that Mr. Witkoff told Mr. Dmitriev about an amazing bridge between Brooklyn and Manhattan he would be happy to sell. Perhaps my cynicism about Mr. Witkoff's curious mix of ingenuousness and rapacity, extreme greediness, is unfair. I don't doubt that he believes in the old idea that a deeper economic relationship between the countries acts as its own guarantee of peace. As he told the journal, if we do all that, and everybody's prospering, and they're all a part of it, and there's upside for everybody, that is going to be naturally a bulwark against future conflicts there, because everybody's thriving. It's a beguiling idea, peace through commerce. Perhaps Mr. Witkoff has been reading Norman Angell's famous The Great Illusion, 1909, whose central argument was that profitable economic engagement between industrialized countries made war virtually unimaginable because it was the real guarantor of the good behavior of one state to another. 5 years after Angell's book was published, the heir to the Austro-Hungarian throne was murdered in a Sarajevo street, and for the next 4 years, the richest and most economically integrated countries in history staged the bloodiest warfare humans have ever produced. But you don't even have to be mindful of history to be skeptical about big claims of peaceful and prosperous coexistence with Mr. Putin's Russia. Over his quarter century in power, the Russian president has demonstrated that for him and his favored courtiers, enrichment through cross-border economic activity is perfectly consistent with, indeed, a helpful facilitator of, violent campaigns to extend Russia's borders. Russia has long been adept at exploiting the cupidity of eager Westerners to advance its political aims. The Soviet Union played the capitalist game better than we did during the Cold War, showering riches on men like Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen in exchange for secrets the Russians hoped would bring about the destruction of our political system. In the heady days after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the oligarchs, many of whom now surround Mr. Putin, welcomed well-meaning Western academics, businessmen, and others to help them plunder their resources and pave the way for the kleptocracy that now holds up his global ambitions. In the end, kleptocrats are going to do what kleptocrats always do. For Americans, making money with Russia in the hope of making peace would be a time-tested mistake. But helping to make money for Russia while it pursues its aims of undermining Western freedom and American leadership would be a crime. The Pepper and Salt cartoon today shows a husband and wife in the kitchen standing. He is drinking coffee and she has her hand on her hip saying, "Is that excuse even based on a true story?" You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 2nd, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening, and have a wonderful day or evening, and stay warm.
December 2nd is Giving Tuesday, a day that encourages people to make a difference in their community. Every large or small act of generosity counts. For 24 hours and only 24 hours, Western New York will come together by showing love for the nonprofit organization that means the most to them. We hope you'll show your love December 2nd by donating to your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We're the only 24/7 volunteer-driven radio station providing free readings of local and national newspapers, magazines, and books for listeners across the Western New York, Rochester, and Southern Ontario region who can't read this critical information because of vision loss, physical or learning disabilities, or other health challenges. We know that's 130,000 of our neighbors. On December 2nd, please consider a gift of any amount to your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service for Giving Tuesday. You can donate through our website, nfradioreading.org. Just click on the Give button in the top right corner of the webpage, or mail a check made payable to Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service to our studios at 1199 Harlem Road, Buffalo, New York, 14227. If you'd like to donate by credit card, give us a call, 716-821-5555, extension 3, and thank you. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Volunteer radio readers broadcast daily readings, 24 hours a day, of newspapers, magazines, books, and other printed matter to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. The Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service has broadcast almost 40 years of radio readings to those without sight. Our broadcast signal is provided at no charge by WNED. Radio reading studios are at 1199.